So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here. Spring has sprung, the 10th of the month has passed, and so it is time for our monthly magazine show. Trends, relationships, your life stories. It's all here. Here's what we've got coming up for you today.
So hypersensitivities to sounds, smells, lights. I was always a very fussy eater. Oh, the radios drove me nuts in the ambulance service. It was like PTSD.
After years of anxiety, difficulties with employment and relationships, I meet the listener who took an assessment for autism at the age of 27. Plus,
trim, trimini, trim, trimini, trim, trim, chiroo. Make sure the beard is neat.
Alex Fox advises facial grooming for oral sex, and Ollie Peart puts his pedal to the metal. That's all to come on this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and hello to Chutzpah84 on Instagram, who says, Ollie, I thought I'd only ever laugh out loud during your Christmas episode, but you've proved me wrong. I presume referring there to me and Mr. Peart taking a dip in Pool Bay last episode in bollock freezing February. It wasn't supposed to be funny. It was meant to be health journalism. Thanks as well to Sharon from Milton Keynes, who's tweeted us on X at The Modern Man. Ollie, I've been listening to your show since day one, but last episode was the first time I've cried. Sue Beer telling her story really touched me. So there we go. We make you laugh. We make you cry. That pretty much sums up a good episode from our perspective. Jim, thank you as well for writing in. Jim wrote in with a potential sponsor for the show, but then didn't leave his email address. So I now can't respond to say whether I'm interested. I know the first rule of business is always be prepared to walk away, but don't actually walk away without being contactable, Jim. Do get back in touch and maybe we can communicate about that. We like money. Thank you as well to Harvey from Chile, who says, Ollie, I've been a podcast enthusiast for years. Answer Me This was one of my standards. Never heard of it. But I stopped for quite a while, perhaps the result of podcast saturation. I hear you, brother. Recently, though, taking a stroll through memory lane, I decided to take another listen to The Modern Man, and I found that your interview style and programme format have matured so much in my hiatus that I've now returned your show to my list of favourites. Hurrah! I mean, it's a strange growth strategy, isn't it? Get people to abandon us in 2015, then come back 9 years later. But we welcome you all. Normally, Harvey continues, I'm a typical podcast listener, consuming but not contributing. But in your case, Ollie, I would like to contribute a grain of sand to accompany my congratulations. And thank you, Harvey. He sent us a fiver on PayPal, not a grain of sand by any means. If all of you did that, then we would have enough to pay for a researcher and switch off the advertising. So we're absolutely open to £5 coming our way. Don't do yourself down. It's all much appreciated. Thanks as well to our new beer money donors, Emma Pettifer and Sarah Danfeld, and also to Jamie Connolly, who's upped his monthly donations to £5 a month. If you can afford to do that, if you can afford to contribute once a month, or if you already contribute, you can afford to contribute more, please do. I've said it before, but it's true. We're a totally independent show. It's just me and producer Matt behind the scenes. So if you like what we do and you can afford to do so, do buy us a beer on our website. And or tell people what you think about the show. I notice on Spotify now, if you're listening on mobile, you can leave a comment under each episode. It's a little Q&A box. So if you're a Spotify listener, that's a great way to draw people in. You can also leave your comments for us there. Another way that you can help us is to reach out with your stories. Now, it really is one of the great privileges of making this show is that we can bring stories from our community to our community. And this month is an example of that. Lexi, who I'm interviewing in the middle feature this month, was a Man fan just like you, who wrote in with her stories. I'd actually said on the show that I'd be interested in hearing from anyone who'd been late diagnosed as autistic, because I'm always fascinated by the idea of living as an adult and then sort of putting the pieces together like a jigsaw puzzle. Oh, maybe I'm autistic. Interestingly, and we had a bunch of you write in when I said that, about 90% of the emails that we got were from women, which is interesting because our audience is pretty evenly split gender-wise. Men, I think, it was a generalisation, obviously, but I think men appear to be identified as autistic earlier in life, in general. And so we wanted to choose a woman to speak to today. Obviously, that means everyone else that wrote to us, though, we didn't feature on the show and we didn't necessarily respond to. So I just want to say now, but it's true of all stories that come our way, we read them all. We don't have time to reply to every single one because, as I said, it is literally me and Matt. And, you know, every year we do a Christmas special, we do a How to Be a Dad episode. So actually, we're only bringing you 10 new stories every year. And, you know, to find the time to work on those, we haven't got time to reply to every single email, but we read every single one. We really do genuinely carefully consider every email we get. And it is a really precious thing for us, and we don't take the responsibility lightly of bringing your stories to our listeners. So thank you for writing in. If you have a story you want to share, do send it our way, and hopefully you can trust us to deliver that story with sympathy and with care. modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and click the feedback form. Before we get going, though, allow me to thank our sponsors for this episode, Readly. They are the app with all the newspapers and magazines you could ever possibly want on one simple subscription. It is amazing, by the way, for food and drink. They've got Olive, they've got Decanter, they've got the Observer Food Monthly, BBC Good Food magazine is on there. Not just national titles, international ones as well. Louisiana Cooking, I'm going to be checking out later. Seafood Jambalaya tonight. I was in the kitchen the other day. I was a glass of wine down, a bit struck for inspiration, and I opened up Readly and I found a recipe for basically sticking some cumin on some carrots and whacking it in the air fryer. And I am never going to eat a carrot any other way ever again. So if cooking is your thing, or gardening, or films, or classic cars, whatever, just for being a man fan, our friends at Readly are offering you an exclusive 3-month free trial, and you get unlimited newspapers and magazines for that. Beano for the kids, The Guardian. Just go to readly.com/man. That's readly.com/MANN. Now do remember to put the man bit, because that's how they know that we sent you, and that helps our podcast too. readly.com/man, and read more of what you love. Right, coming up on today's episode, you will learn what the best dating venues are for an autistic partner. You'll learn what the Baloo is, it's nothing to do with the Jungle Book, and you'll learn what Max Verstappen does every Wednesday. Let's go. It's time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested with Ollie Pitt, brought to you this month by Lemsip.
yeah, Lemsip, max strength.
You're not feeling great and you've still managed to come out of your cave to do this, Ollie, so thank you.
Oh, no problem. I'm not doing it for you, I'm doing it for the listeners.
Your priorities are correct.
Yeah, they are.
Get well soon. Thanks. In the meantime, Francis in Leeds had a task for you, which was to investigate esports moving into real world equivalents.
I've learned that very quickly, if you start descending into that world, you find out that there aren't that many esports that you can take up that do lead into real world sport, because it's very hard to replicate real world sport. Think of tennis. If you play tennis, you can't create a computer game where you can run around your front room and swing and get the sort of like the feel. You can play.
Oh, this is embarrassing. It's a man that's obviously never played Wii tennis. Can't believe it. I don't want to hit you when you're down. But
yeah, or football. A football simulator. The best football simulator is buying a football and kicking it around a field. Yeah. To try and simulate that.
Never played FIFA 96. What is this?
FIFA 94 was the peak of FIFA. I just want to highlight that. I always used to play against Qatar because okay. They were shite.
I mean, before we poo-poo the entire concept, I suppose let's just define for those of us who are just joining the 21st century what esports actually are. Because I sort of feel like I have a sense of that, but in reality, I don't watch that much real sports. I'm not going to watch esports. So I don't really know what it is, like in terms of it being an organised thing with tournaments and stuff.
Mm. I mean, we've explored this a little bit in a previous episode, but it's basically competitive computer gaming. It's as simple as that. And it spans lots of different games. So there's League of Legends, which is sort of like fantasy, and you get into teams and you sort of blow up trolls and all that kind of stuff. You can tell that I lost interest within about 5 minutes. And then FIFA have leagues as well where you can play online.
So some of them have real world sports equivalents, but some of them presumably are just like Zelda or Mario. Or
yeah, exactly.
Then
exactly.
That qualifies you for nothing.
Yeah, but the one sport that does seem to translate into real world very, very well is motor racing. Because, well, you might remember, even back in the day, years and years ago at your arcade, you could have a steering wheel with some pedals on Gran Turismo and you could speed around. And that was sort of a precursor to what became better and better sort of simulators, if you like, for motor racing. And today, if you look at motor racing esports, you will find a largely, I'm going to say, hidden industry that is massive. Like, you're going to open the door to a world which I just had no idea existed. So,
okay, what motorsport game? Because whilst you were saying, oh, you remember back in the 80s in the arcade, you had steering wheel and pedals. Yes, and I remember there being nothing like driving a car. I mean, there's a little bit of resistance, isn't there? But not much on the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And if you're replicating that at home with a console, there's nothing like that.
Yeah, and just so you know, we call that feedback now, Ollie. We don't call it resistance. And we don't call it software. We call it a platform.
Are you an e-sporter now?
I'm an e-sporter.
Spent 3 weeks looking into this.
I just know the lingo. That's all. We'll start with the software. The platform. It's called iRacing. Now, there are other platforms out there, but iRacing is the industry standard. It needs to be made clear, because nobody that I spoke to spoke about it in any other terms. This is not a computer game, okay? This is a simulator, and it is meticulous. This company, iRacing, speak to all of the major car manufacturers. They get all of the physics and the design and the engineering of the cars to replicate them as closely as possible. Their goal is solely to create the most realistic racing experience possible.
Okay, but when you say platform, what literally, where is the seat? Is it in your house or do you have to go to their simulator?
So the platform, iRacing, is the software. You subscribe to that. It's going to cost you £150 a year to do that every year. And you sign up to it and you get a license. You can't use gamer tags. So there's no Ollie the Game Hound 123. You would have to be Ollie Man. Uh-huh. And you get given a license and then you have to get the physical equipment, which will sit in your home, or if you have a partner, likely your garage.
Okay, so it's like the high-end fitness subscription stuff. It's like having a gym machine at home that costs thousands of pounds, like a very high-end car simulator.
Yeah, actually, the best thing to compare it to, and this was, I spoke to the head of esports at Motorsport UK about this, a guy called Paul Crawford. He said the best thing to compare it to is the cycling simulators. So where you have an actual bike, but then on the back, you remove the wheel and you stick it into like a travelator thing, I guess, and you can put a screen in front of you. So yeah, it's kind of a bit like that, but typically you would need a seat, steering wheel, pedals, and at least a screen, and you need a PC or a games console to get started.
I do wonder, though, on cost, whether that's really cheaper than getting involved in karting, because that's the traditional route into motor racing in this country, isn't it? Which, if you live near a kart track, is expensive. But it's not madly out of the range of people. I mean, that's how people like Lewis Hamilton ended up doing it in the first place, right? You can enter that sport without much money behind you.
Well, it is incredibly expensive to get into karting. And actually, this is one of the most interesting things about where this sim racing thing is. So I spoke to a chap called Johnny Elliott, who started sim racing. He's always been into cars, but he started sim racing back in COVID because he's just into cars. He was looking for something to do. And fortunately, he was able to retain some of his cash and he wanted to spend it. So he got into sim racing and he bought himself what they call a rig, which is your steering wheel and your pedals and your screens and stuff.
What does that cost, by the way?
His setup cost him around £9,000.
Wow. And that's cheaper than karting, you reckon?
It's considerably cheaper than karting.
But when you go karting, you don't own the kart, do you? You just pay to use the track.
Well, no. If you want to get into the level of karting that is competitive... And the level where you can potentially lead onto F1 in particular, but even just being competitive, that higher level, the really high level, is £500,000 a year.
Is it?
£500,000 a year, yeah.
Okay, so £9,000, considerably cheaper.
Bargain, mate. I'll have two.
I mean, I was about to say of all sports. I mean, I suppose it would also be true of, like, horse riding or cycling, actually. You've given the example of cycling. But of a lot of sports, motorsport feels like one you'd be into because you can feel the real wind through your hair and you get that sense of danger as you're taking the corners and you hear the sounds and the smells. And sitting in your garage on a simulator just isn't the same as maybe is more the same for something like golf or something.
So one of the biggest names that's into sim racing at the moment is Max Verstappen. You might know that name.
I've heard of him, yes.
Max Verstappen runs a sim team called Redline, right?
And disappointing, isn't it, when people's hobbies are so similar to their careers?
Yeah.
You know, it would have been nice if Max Verstappen had a different string to his bow completely. But, the weekends he does opera or something. Do you know what I mean?
But maybe it showcases just how passionate he is about it all, you know? Yeah. He races every single Wednesday. So he'll go on with his team on a Wednesday and he'll broadcast it on Twitch. Now, he is probably the most famous racing driver in the world, but very, very few people know that he does this. But one of the reasons he does it, and he has said this in an interview, he finds it just as hard, if not harder, than racing in Formula One, because you have to have exactly the same sort of mental agility, I suppose, or strength to race against certain people in this sport. And because the sims are so accurate and so much like the real world tracks, it really is just as hard. The only thing that is removed, a couple of things. One is the imminent fear of death if you fuck it up.
Exactly.
And the other
one, the exhilarating fear of that.
Well,
one of the things that motivates people, isn't it?
Well, there is. I think there would be a certain amount of exhilaration in the same way that people get that from computer games. You know, there's a certain excitement with that and entertainment. But the other is that you don't get the physical sense of G-force. But everything else, the physics of it, the feedback from the steering wheel, the pedals, all of those things, which are very, very mechanical, are getting more and more accurate and more close to the real thing, to the point where quite a lot of famous F1 drivers do regularly use iRacing just to keep their foot in when they're not racing. So Fernando Alonso does it. Johnny, who I spoke to, he was on a practice session once in a race and Rubens Barrichello turned up. You know, it's that kind of world.
And it's not VR. You don't put a headset on. Why?
Well, do you know what? I wonder if that is, you know, the next step, really, because you wear a helmet whilst racing, so why not?
Yeah, exactly.
I think maybe screen resolution would have to be better. As you know, I'm a bit of a VR nerd. I don't think it's quite there yet. And Paul, when I was chatting to him about it, he said, look, you know, the technology's coming on so quickly now that it really is getting more and more close to the real thing, as close as you can get.
Okay, all right, so that's the theory. In practice, who has made the transition then from esports to actually making a career as a sports person?
Will Byron won the Daytona 500 last year, one of the biggest, if not the biggest spectator sport in the world. And it was won by Will Byron, who started off in simulators. That's how he got into NASCAR.
And didn't have a parallel career in NASCAR as well, just from simulators up?
Simulators up.
How do you get spotted then? Is there like a league? You're racing against other people in real time, are you?
Yeah, so you can enter specific leagues and they're operated by various different people. So Motorsport UK have got their own leagues. They operate one for Porsche as well, which they set up an online version of the Porsche Super Cup, which is the supporting race for Formula One. But the thing about these events, some of them at least, is they're broadcast with professional commentators. So they are, you know, people can watch them. They can watch you sort of take part in it. So there are ways that you can be spotted because these are broadcast, you know, for people to watch, much like you'd watch a normal, you know, normal motor race.
So you haven't given this a go yourself, I'm going to guess, because it's expensive.
Because it's expensive, and actually getting the kit, unlike some of the free stuff that I'm able to get to try out, this is big, it's heavy, it's difficult, expensive, and frankly, I don't have the space for it. I have been fortunate enough to try an arcade-type Formula One simulator at F1 Arcade in London, which if you haven't been, you can basically go along. They've got a bar, and then they've got a load of F1 simulators around.
Right.
But these are arcade ones. They're designed to be played whilst you're getting smashed on Peroni, right? That's what they're for. But even those were really good fun. You can race in, like, you know, in teams and stuff, and they had a great, it's like, it kind of, it felt as real as F1 as I suppose I'm ever going to feel, in that it had like an F1 looking type steering wheel, and you had all the pedals and that kind of stuff.
Shall I tell you what me and the kids played in an arcade in Blackpool?
Oh, Pac-Man.
Life-size Hungry Hippos.
Ooh, life-size?
So good. Yeah, you sit on the back hippos. Of the hippo like a cowboy. And you go, bah, 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 and you can play and get four of you on each hippo.
See, what sport's that going to translate into, Ollie?
If there was a real-life Hungry Hippo tournament with real people on real hippos' backs playing real Hungry Hippos, then that would get me watching sport.
Yeah, rodeo. Yeah. You could get into rodeo.
Hippo rodeo.
Yeah, hippo rodeo. I'd watch that. I mean, animal rights activists would probably have something to say about it. But
especially if it was in Blackpool Tower.
At the top.
I suppose the concern is, on the one hand, innovations like this can make sports more accessible in terms of gender and background. But on the other hand, you know, a sport like motorsport can say, look at all of these people coming through grassroots doing the sim stuff, and we'll pick the very best. Without having to really invest in making the Premier League of their sport more diverse and inclusive in the first place.
Well, all of the F1 teams that exist now have to, it's a ruling, they have to have an esports team. So all of them, Williams, McLaren, Ferrari, all of those guys, yeah, they have to have one. And part of it is for exactly that reason. It's sort of, you know, investing in future talent. But compared to having to invest your own money, what, £500,000 to get into karting back in the day, and you might find some sponsors or whatever to do that, it's way more accessible. You're not dependent on incredibly wealthy parents like, say, Lando Norris, whose dad's worth £200 million. You know, like, you could theoretically just slap it on a credit card, get good, and then next stop, Silverstone.
And as a spectator, is there a place you can go to watch esport? Like, it hasn't caught on with real sport, has it? I never go to a bar and see Sky Sports esports playing in the background.
Yes is the short answer. It's not a dedicated place, but it's places like Twitch and Discord and all of those kind of platforms, and even YouTube to a certain extent. But Paul had a really interesting take on this, which is that, you know, Max Verstappen does this live broadcast every single Wednesday. You get really amazing access to him and his mates. They chat live, kind of unfiltered, uncensored. But for some reason, the industry don't talk about it. The broadcasters won't talk about it. Red Bull don't really want people to know that Max Verstappen plays computer games. It's almost seen as his, like, dirty little secret. But he loves it. And it's a shame, because where else would these broadcasters get access to somebody who is notoriously difficult to get access to? He's giving you sort of unprecedented access once a week for however many hours whilst he's sort of playing around with his mates. So, yeah, it's a funny one. I think it just hasn't got the publicity. Whether or not people will buy into it to watch as a spectator, simply because there isn't that element of, you know, I mean, risk, I suppose. You know, that is one of the things with motor racing. Obviously, nobody wants to see anybody get hurt. One of the sort of amazing things about watching F1 is that you can watch these people hurtling around a track at 200 miles an hour and think, how the fuck are you doing that? Like, how are you putting yourself in the headspace to take a corner at that speed, knowing that if you get it wrong, you're dead?
If you're interested in hearing Ollie talking more about Formula One, there's another podcast with more of that as well, isn't there?
There is. For F1's sake, I'm the host. I do it with Phil.
For F1's sake. That's been going for years, though. You didn't used to be the host, did you?
No, I didn't used to be the host. I've recently been recruited. I did a bit last year.
You're not going to muscle in any further here, no. I hope you know.
Last year, I was just their sim racer. This year, I've made the cut. I'm on the team. And it's the F1 podcast you don't go to for analysis, because there's way too many of those. You just go there for a laugh and for some general banterings about F1. Yeah.
Chat, yes.
Yeah.
As if you decamp to the pub with friends who just watched the race. That's the vibe, isn't it, basically?
Yes. And it used to be recorded in the pub until I joined.
Yeah. And then you were like, guys, don't you know, my generation, we don't drink, yeah?
My generation, I'm 38, Ollie. No, they just didn't want to invite me to the pub.
Ollie, would you like to know what your challenge is for next month?
Yes, please.
It comes from Ed in Crouch End, who says, in this election year, I'd like to know whether AI and fake news are making a difference to the way the main parties are campaigning. Could Ollie please investigate what new techniques our political parties will be using to swing our vote?
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Well,
yes, because I actually saw the other day a faked image from Donald Trump supporters, not from his campaign. I hasten to add, but his supporters had created an image of him seemingly with lots of black voters. But it was
Yes, I saw that. Was it were you watching the, we're saying this like it was in an obscure place. Were you watching the Panorama about that?
No, I was on the BBC News website.
Fine, okay. It's Mariana Spring anyway, has been doing a whole load of stuff about that going on in America, like the fake robocalls as well. I think there was a Joe Biden fake, well, it was his real voice, but they'd used that AI stuff to make him sound like he was telling his voters not to go out and vote because it wasn't important on that day.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because actually, we've done some deepfake stuff before where, if you remember, I put your face on Boris Johnson.
I do remember. I was haunted by it.
Yeah. And since then, I know for a fact that, you know, being able to sort of replicate people in their voices has come on so far. I was actually able to replicate David Attenborough's voice. I don't know if that was legal, actually. But anyway, I did it. And it was very, very easy. So, yeah, this is interesting.
It is interesting, but you're right, we have done deepfakes before. We have done quite a lot of stuff about AI before. So our audience, I guess, have a preliminary understanding of that.
They should do.
But there's more, isn't there? There's bound to be more. Like with the actual election happening on both sides of the Atlantic this year, there's bound to be techniques that we are not yet aware of that the politicos are thinking about when it comes to, I guess, just getting people to go out and vote.
You've scared me now.
But it's also the thing with general elections, because they're only every 4 or 5 years, it's a real marker of how fast technology moves, isn't it? Because, you know, at the last one, it was all about using hashtags on Twitter to try and change the debate. And the one before that, it was probably about politicians doing YouTube monologues. Do you know what I mean? And now we're in a stage where it's way beyond that. It's like, can I believe that what I'm looking at is the thing you tell me it is?
Yeah, it's frightening. And I'm sort of tentative but excited to find out more.
If you have a trend you would like Ollie to test for you on the next edition of the podcast, what do you need to do with it, Ollie?
Head to modernman, that's with two n's, .co.uk, and head to the feedback form, which is a great place to go, because even if you don't fill it out, you'll see Ollie Mann and Alex Fox holding some pornos.
Thank you, Ollie. In a moment you will meet man fan Lexi, who'll share her story of late diagnosed autism. But first, it's our record of the month, and you might well wonder how many talented pop stars can come out of the Isle of Wight in a year. Well, if you're into Wet Leg, check out this by Lauren Hibbert. It's called Second Prettiest Girl in the World, and it's out now.
I saw you at the movies, she was kissing your neck. It's a shame you missed the part when they were cutting off their heads. She's staring.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now, there are reckoned to be around 700,000 autistic people in the UK. Most have difficulties with communication, social interaction, and sensory issues with noise, smells, and bright lights, which can be painful. It's a lifelong disability which affects how people can communicate and interact, and as we all know, there's a spectrum. But what if you don't know you're autistic? My guest today, Lexi, made it to 27 years old before she took a clinical assessment, and things had reached a crisis by that time. So just to warn you, this conversation does include references to self-harm. She looks back now on her younger life as a series of trigger events. The first when she was 17 and her family upped sticks to Scotland.
So bear in mind, I lived in Norfolk from the age of one. You know, family were there, you know, we had one set of my grandparents down the road, my other set were only a couple of hours away, as with the rest of my family, and I was into horses and the animals. We then moved to Scotland and so left all that family behind. Mm. I didn't really have a set friendship group, but I still had friends. But yeah, that was very difficult, leaving that stuff behind. And
your grandparents in particular, or your friends in particular, or the horses in particular?
The horse.
The horse.
Yeah, I'd had that horse for 5 or 6 years. And yeah, so when we moved to Scotland, I was basically being uprooted from everything I knew for 16 years. I had nothing. I basically would go to school, came back and did nothing. Maybe chat on MSN. I didn't really have sport. I didn't have anything. I put on a little bit of weight.
Why was it hard to make new friends? Why was it hard to establish a new life for yourself? Why was it hard to find new horses?
It's just a very rural area. There's only 17 on our year. There was one person in the year who had a horse, and I went and rode hers for a bit, but she was like a half hour drive away.
Mm.
And, you know, I made friends for that year, but I knew I wasn't planning on staying around. And they were all going off to university. So it was just all very much temporary. I applied because of the change in my education circumstances. I got declined from universities. So I had no direction.
Mm.
I think that's probably why the move was probably the massive trigger point for me, because I've been removed from my routine. I've been removed from what makes me happy, what gave me joy. My family know that, my parents know this. When you're left without direction, I was someone who loves direction and loves planning and loves having something to look forward to then just have nothing and void. It was, yeah.
After a year out, Lexi did get to university, studying sport science at Oxford Brookes, where she also took up rowing.
I was doing well at uni. I was getting good marks. I was online for a first. But I was certainly struggling with bouts of low mood. It kind of hit a point in my final year where I ended up having a really quite bad bout of depression.
Did you know that's what it was?
I thought initially it was just stress, because rowing, the ultimate goal at the end of the year is to get a boat for Henley.
Uh-huh.
Henley Royal Regatta is the ultimate goal. And it looked like I wasn't going to get a boat. And I was like, have I worked for these 3 years and I'm never going to compete at Henley? Because I was getting pressure from the coaches. If you don't turn up, you don't get a boat. And I was turning up. I was turning up probably more consistently than any of the other coxes were. But they got better relationships. And this is the clicky thing. They just got on, you know, the more sociable side. So that's who the crews want.
Mm.
And it got to a point in my graduation. We were due to go to camp in the evening. They were eventually saying, no, don't go to your graduation, come to camp. And I was like, I've got a first. I was like, oh no, you should go to your graduation. You're the only one who's got like a first, you should go. 5 minutes before my graduation due to start, I get a text saying, you've not got a lift, you've got to make your own way down. And camp was like, what, Taunton area somewhere? Devon, wherever that is? You know, from Oxford. I had no money, it's the end of the year. And I've been told 5 minutes before my graduation, I had to find my own way to this thing that was, you know, potentially determine where I was going to get a boat or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I freaked out.
But again, it's just that thing of not having a plan in place.
That's, I think it was more the plan completely disintegrating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the panic. I was meant to be having this great time. My family, my brother had come down as well last minute. It was basically like the world had come down. This event, I was meant to be really enjoying myself. This achievement. I've spent 3 years. I got a first to this degree. Everything just, it felt like the whole world had just tumbled down. So I had a plan, you know, it was meant to be a camp for 3 days. So after my graduation, I then just tanked for 3 days. That was probably the first time I was getting to a point of where I was being more violent to myself. So like hitting myself on the thigh, slapping myself on the cheek, anything to distract myself from that emotion of anxiousness.
Mm.
And I was doing it quite a lot at that point.
Would you describe that now, looking back on it, as self-harm? Because there's a line, isn't there?
Yeah, it is self-harm. And I started it when I was 6.
I mean, how serious did that get?
Nothing would leave marks that lasted longer than a couple of days. No, I never cut myself. But I just remember reading this magazine when I was a teenager saying, if you feel anxious, pinging a rubber band on your wrist is a pain to distract yourself. So that was from a teenager. I'd use it as a, you know, that hitting, biting tongue sort of thing as a way of that distraction emotion, because that's what an advice magazine had said to do.
Mm.
It was getting really bad. And I'd had really bad sore throat, cough for weeks. And so I went to the GP to say about this cough, I can't get rid of it. Broke down in tears. And he was like, I think you've got depression. Mm. I don't think you've got this. I think you're so run down that you've just can't shake off this bug. And he was like, I'm going to refer you to the talking services.
Did this come as a surprise?
No, yeah, I didn't think I was, although I said I was a bit low mood and depressed, I didn't think I was clinically depressed. Mm.
Your dad's a GP as well. What was his view on what you'd just been told?
Didn't say anything.
But you told him?
No.
Ah.
No.
Why?
I think they're aware. I would chat with them regularly, but I don't think, and they knew I was a bit down. I don't think I actually told, I don't believe I told them I went to the doctors. I think I hid it in hindsight. I think I hid the letter.
Why?
I didn't want them to know. I think because at that point, I didn't want them to worry about me. I think that was the case.
You've got someone in the house there who day in, day out deals with that sort of situation.
Doctors are doctors at work. At home, they're just people.
After university, Lexi applied for a job in the ambulance service.
I've always been interested in what the body does. That's why I chose that first degree, sport and exercise science. I love to know what happens to the body under stress, mm-hmm. you know, how it works.
What was it like being a paramedic?
Loved it and hated it. And actually, although I always find social situations quite difficult, especially maintaining friendships, I probably should clarify, is I'm great with new people. I will chat your ear off. But I find it very difficult to then maintain those friendships. And weirdly, through the ambulance service, because you are taught to then talk to patients about finding stuff about them, I probably started learning better how to interact with people more term, because I actually learned it's okay to ask questions.
That's interesting. So the manual they use to teach you how to diagnose someone who's having an incident.
Yeah.
You found useful in social situations.
History taking. So you're given a formula of which you ask people stuff.
Mm.
I'm great at that. I'm great with formulas, great with algorithms. I'm great with just chatting with people off the cuff. But this was a formula of which, okay, now I'm not just talking about myself. I'm having to ask about you and how you're feeling. And you get to experience all different scenarios. So road traffic accidents, either minor or severe, heart attacks, a little granny who's fallen down, or they've set off the care alarm and you've woken them up in the middle of the night because they've rolled on it and you feel bad because you've woken them up, and then you go, hello, you okay? And then you walk out. to people with mental health crises. Mm. I certainly learned to listen more. Yeah, and then my granddad died. My granddad, my dad's dad, he's a GP as well. And I was actually living with them at the time I applied for the ambulance service.
Mm.
And I knew he was really proud of me. And he was the first grandparent who'd actually passed. He was, you know, the first, you know, person of any significance in my family who passed away in my adult life.
Mm.
That was a second trigger moment, big life event for me. First being the move when I was 17. Second being that time my granddad died. So how was I then? I was 25. So another change in routine. I wasn't sleeping. There was issues at work with interpersonal relationships at work. It was very clicky there. I was going from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, for a few weeks. And then I was going back to shift work, where you're doing 12-hour shifts, either 6 in the morning to 6 in the afternoon, or 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning. And you're driving as well. You're tired. I found it very difficult to do all the driving at night. I genuinely had times I almost crashed because I was just like nodding off. When your routine's changing, you're not sleeping well. I wasn't eating well. I was miserable, which heightens my anxiety. It heightens your perception of how things you're seeing things. When you're not feeling great, I was just picking up bug after bug after bug. And I spiraled massively.
For anyone in the circumstances you're describing, you know, you've got an exhausting job and then someone you're very emotionally attached to dies, that's going to be difficult. What's different about your situation is it sounds like you were already in a position where it just needed a thing to push you over the edge back into being depressed again.
Yeah. I'd been cycling and out of it for years, but I'd always managed to boot myself out of it to a certain extent. So I never really got to a point where I was, I'd say I was happy and joyful, but I was sort of neutral. But I was basically in this permanently anxious state. I realised I needed something I could look after. I needed something I needed to focus on that was mine. Got a dog. Got my little dachshund, Belle. If I don't think I had her to focus on out of the depression, I don't think I would have got out. I was even, it was even at that point my dad realised how bad it got. And that's when the self-harm at that point was really quite, that was when I was actually leaving marks and harming myself. To the point, I think I even scared my mum. My mum said she'd never been so scared. When I literally called her and said I was literally scared. I was going to go to the kitchen and grab a knife.
And that was real. You were scared you were going to do that. And you called out for help for that.
I'd been hallucinating that morning. I'd come off just on some night shifts. I woke up. I generally thought someone had broken in my house. And I was panicking. And I was like, I needed to, you know, get a knife. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. And I was scared I was going to turn it on myself because I would use that image in my head instead of hitting myself. I'd use that image of putting a knife in my leg to try and, as a way of like anything to distract myself from the feelings I was feeling. And in the end, I just, I called my mum and I said, I need you to come down. I think you need to take me to hospital. And in the end, she took me to my work and we spoke to my work and I was like, I need to take time off. And I was bad.
Why do you think you were hallucinating? Because you weren't taking drugs that would cause that, were you?
No, but I had started on an antidepressant about 3 weeks earlier. I think I'd probably only had maybe 4 or 5 hours sleep over like 6 days.
Why had you only... Because I understand it's a very stressful job and you're working shifts and, you know, you're eating badly and all of that. There should still be time for you to be sleeping more than an hour a day. So what's going on there?
So I'm very much a routine person. So sleep routine. I find it very difficult to adapt my sleep. So day shift, I will always get up. I'll wake. I don't need to set an alarm. I'm like awake, like 15 minutes from my alarm, 99% of the time. So after a night shift, you get in. I try and go to sleep because I'm tired, but I'll maybe only sleep 2 to 4 hours because my body just won't let me stay asleep for the rest of the day. I was doing like 4 night shifts, day off, a couple of days off, 3 day shifts, day off, 3 night shifts, 3 days off. 4 day shifts. Yeah. Nights, days. You know, it was a lot of... I don't adapt very easily.
So was there any medical intervention at this point?
Yeah. So I'd previously been to the GP and they'd put me on antidepressants. And after a few weeks, I went back to see the nurse. And we were discussing, could we identify basically what led to the depression? And through the course of the discussion, she suggested, have I ever thought about autism being autistic? And I went, I did a trait thing once, but I'd never really thought it. I just thought I had anxiety and depression. She advised me saying, look, by the way, the waiting list in the NHS is 2 years. You're better off going private. You know, if you're in a job and employment, you're better off paying for it. So I had a thought, didn't do anything about it for a bit. Went back to work. And then, again, things weren't going very well still. So I decided to go, I inquired, looked, did some research, found a place in Gloucester.
That did what? Autism diagnosis?
Yeah. They're trained in giving these assessments, but they're not there to try and offer any medical help.
Okay, so in between, you know, the nurse first mentioning the A word and you booking an appointment 2 months later in a private clinic, did you do a bit of Googling? Because it obviously set off a light in your head.
Yeah, so I redid that test I did years before, and I scored the same, weirdly. And it's, you know, I took more notice of it, and I was like, actually, I've got traits suggesting I'd probably be likely to be autistic.
Like what? What were the things that suddenly you thought, oh yes,
tick? Obsessions with things, obsession with routine,
yeah.
Sort of hypersensitivities to sounds, smells, lights. I was always a very fussy eater. So tastes, textures, and, you know, very sensitive sound. That's the problem with, I can't really sleep because I'm very, very sound sensitive. And, oh, the radios drove me nuts in the ambulance service. It was like PTSD. So I had the assessment. By God, it was baffling. I don't know if you've ever seen an autism assessment, but I sat through it. Some of the questions, it went on for 2 hours.
What sort of things?
So you get asked questions, obviously, about your background. So things, obviously, what you like eating, what your relationships were like as a kid. And you get to do some tasks. So you have to read a story book. You get a picture book and you have to try and tell a story with it, which I was just like, there's a picture of a frog. And by the looks of it, there's a man who is got a crown on. And I was baffled by this. I was just describing what was I could see. And you're given like these objects and then you're told, you know, make a story out of them. And I was just like, I just put them together and made a little model and make it do a little dance. And I just felt this was baffling. And they also ask you questions, experiences, relationships. All I remember thinking the entire 2 hours of which this assessment went on for is feeling incredibly uncomfortable because I was wearing shorts. It was summer and I was on a plastic, your vinyl covered seat. And so I was fidgeting. I was constantly wrapping my feet around the chair legs. I was just trying to find everything. My hands were constantly running along the edge of the desk. So not only are the examiners there, obviously getting your verbal responses as well as your actions to these tasks, but they're also observing your behavior.
Is it a bit like a driving test in the sense that you get a sense halfway through yourself whether you've passed? Like, were they giving you a few nods and winks like, yeah, you probably are?
No, they're a completely neutral face. So this is the point. I've always found people's facial expressions very difficult to read. Sometimes there's a friendly face and actually it's more just, is actually quite an antagonistic face. And in hindsight, I've tried to pick up since then about how to read a, you know, face, like facial expressions, like micro expressions. And so I've had to learn through essentially cognitive behavioral therapy about how to read people's faces, but I've done that on my own rather than through that's over the years. But they were completely blank. They were giving nothing. And for me, a blank face is usually not a good sign because that's what my dad had, you know. Smile, good thing. Blank face, bad. Yeah, so they were smiling at me when I came back in the next time because they didn't give you any indication. They said, no, we need to go back because there's two assessors there so they can ratify their scoring, essentially. So I went back and they sat down and they said, they gave me a little sort of explanation of like a little line of saying, obviously, autism is a spectrum. We all know that. And we have those with, we say, sort of severe autism, so nonverbal, not functioning, basically the point where it's defined as a disability. Mm-hmm. You then have this, what was in old-fashioned terms is called Asperger's. So those who are, it's not necessarily disability, it's definitely, it's sort of that gray space between disability and difficulty, where it's actually they probably would need additional assistance, but essentially they could probably look after themselves, but not necessarily be without assistance, function independently in society. Mm-hmm. And then we definitely believe you are autistic, but we put you in this higher end called it's called high functioning autism.
So that's sort of passing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Masking, people use the word
masking,
sometimes.
Yeah.
So you read like a normal person, but underneath it, there's something different going on.
That's one term you'll find a lot of people get in the autism community will get annoyed with.
Yeah, of course. Normal. Yeah, of course. Well, I used it knowingly, but yeah.
But basically, I can function independently. I would be able to survive without any external assistance. However, for the nuances of fitting in with society, I might need some additional adjustments.
Still to come, what happened when Lexi began to live for the first time with those adjustments in place? And how does knowing she's autistic affect her dating? That's when The Modern Man returns. After this.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Back to my conversation with Lexi now. And after years of severe depression and anxiety, difficulties with employment and relationships, suddenly, at the age of 27, she has a diagnosis. She's autistic. How did that feel?
I can definitely tell you it was a sense of relief. And I think that's a very common theme in people who do receive diagnoses of anything, is that, oh, I'm not a shit, I'm not abnormal. There is something I can put a name to.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I am, maybe. You know, I still didn't quite believe it.
Did you start unpicking everything in your past, all the things you told us about?
Yeah, so, you know, making sure none of my food touched and very particular. That's a very common theme you'll find with adults and children who get diagnosed. But also toe walking. So toe walking, about 10% of the general population will toe walk. So they walk on their toes rather than heel toe.
Oh, all the time, not just some of the time.
Yeah, majority of the time, yeah. Whereas about in the people diagnosed with autism, around about 20, 25% of usually toe walking. And there's something about whether it's a neurological thing or a sensation thing. No one really seems to know. There's a few theories. But I was like, the amount of times as a child I was told to stop dragging my feet, you know, walk properly. And I remember seeing there was a Channel 4, you know, embarrassing bodies thing where like a child was brought in and made to have those splints because the child was toe walking and he was made to have splints to stop him from doing so.
Yeah.
In case it made your tendon short. And I was just thinking, that's associated with autism? Or at least it's correlated, should I say. It's associated. It's not proven to be something, this causes that. But it's more common in those with autism than it is in those in the general population, as is obviously anxiety and depression. In fact, actually, that's how most adults will probably come round to their diagnoses. It's usually because of some degree of anxiety and depression.
How would your depression have been different, though, had you been equipped with the knowledge that you were on the autistic spectrum?
So when I was dipping in and out of depression in the year before my diagnosis, a year or so, I was told I could refer myself to talking therapy. So this is the second time it came up, and this time I committed and went along with it. So it was like a, you know, phone session and every week for a few weeks. And my scores were just getting, you'd have to do you ask these questions from the actual anxiety and depression scoring thing each week, and mine were getting worse and worse. And they were giving me things to think about, CBT. It wasn't working because I wasn't really getting to the crux of what was making me depressed. But the thing about the autism diagnosis is actually the importance of routine. And that's not just sleep, but food. So what I'm eating, when I'm eating. You know, sports are a massive thing for me, going out and keeping that in my, you know, routine. And as soon as if I get ill, that has to drop off. So I get more low mood because I'm not active. And it's like a vicious cycle then, because then I can't, because I get a low mood, I'm more susceptible to bugs, and then I can't shake anything off, and I keep myself off sport because I'm ill, and, you know. And,
so, I mean, that explains why you felt this way when you were doing a job that was so exhausting and working shifts and all the rest of it. But the solution should be, well, I should be able to adapt the job around my circumstances.
Yeah.
Could you do that? Could you adapt that job? Or is it actually not possible to be a paramedic and be as you were?
So I personally believe no. I don't think. So the siren, the noise of the sirens, the noise of the radio suddenly going off, I was permanently in a state of alertness. And fear, that social side, the fear, you're working with a single person for 12 hours a day, 3 days in a row. And if you don't get on, it's miserable. there's not a lot of adjustments I think could be made for frontline work in the ambulance service for someone with autism.
So what have you ended up doing?
So if it wasn't for my time in the ambulance service, I would never have decided to go into medicine. It was like middle of the night on a shift, brief moment of downtime. I was looking at other options because I just knew things weren't going well in the ambulance service and I wanted something different. And I found graduate entry medicine, which is affordable because part of it's funded and it's only 4 years. So when I got offered for interviews, I said, is there, you know, any adjustments? And I felt like such a fraud saying, yes, I have autism.
Why do you feel like a fraud?
It was only like months after the diagnosis. And I was like, you know, I've been fine for years. I did a first degree and I didn't need any adjustments. I got a first without any adjustments. I was fine. I felt like a fraud asking for these things.
No, I mean... Obviously, that's why they ask the question, right?
Yeah.
They're probably delighted to have someone who says yes.
Yeah.
Justify why they do it.
Yeah, so I kind of just went, you know, quieter room sort of thing, you know, extra time for tests so I can understand things. Because that's things I was always very close to the time limits on exams and stuff.
And have you encountered people with autism in your job?
When I was on my pediatric placement, when I found out there was an outpatient assessment clinic for autism children, I was like, I want to sit on this and see it from the other side, essentially. And I was utterly gobsmacked to see it was the same questionnaire. So I don't get to see the questionnaire as the participant, but as the clinician, I got to see it and I recognized all the questions. Bear in mind, this was what, 4 years later, three years later after my assessment. And I went, I remember that. And I was sitting there watching these children. There's varying. I think it was a 14-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 9-year-old getting assessments. So I got to see the varying degrees. And I was watching the interactions. And I just remember thinking during the assessment, I was like, these children are fine. What's none of them was wrong with any of their reactions. It's like, it's what I would do. You know, I could see this girl wrapping her legs around the chair, and I was like, oh, I do that, it's fine. You know, she was looking really baffled about all the same. She literally did the exact same response to the storybook as I did. She would just describe what was in the book. And I was saying, yeah, it's fine. And another thing is, I was saying, they're all just normal kids. And I was just listening to the assessors talk through their scores afterwards, and like, yeah, they're definitely autistic. Like, really? Oh, and it was just this degree of not getting my head around it. I thought that's how I'd respond. Weirdly, I actually felt more reassured about my own diagnosis. So I just went, oh, okay. They think these kids have got autism and that's exactly what I would be doing.
Mm.
So that must mean I am autistic.
And you're single. What's it like dating with the knowledge that you're autistic? Do you declare that up front? Are you looking for people that have experience of that? How does it affect it?
So I have on and off, depending on the situation, mentioned it very early. That's more recently. Certainly shortly after my diagnosis, didn't mention it at all. Didn't think it was relevant. But what's really funny, what makes me laugh every single time, is the amount of times people, in fact, not even to people I'm dating, when I say it and they're like, I would never have guessed. Because you come across as so sociable and chatty. And, you know, everyone says, oh, you're so sociable. Because I feel that pressure. If I don't talk, then I'm going to be seen as unsocial. I'm overthinking. But in terms of dating, I actually find it very difficult to sort of go outside of my little box, especially group scenarios. And I feel very shy around people I'm attracted to. And I end up just like, panic.
So is it easier to say up front?
Sometimes. Depends on the situation.
Well, okay, let's put it this way. Is it on your dating profile?
No. God, no.
No.
No. Because I know the stigma of it.
And yet, if people knew, if they were equipped with that knowledge, it would help them understand their interactions with you better.
True, which is why I sort of mention it. Usually after that initial got to know me, so I'm like saying, I'm not, you know, that sort of person, you know, the severely autistic person. I'm me.
Mm. But actually, what are the allowances that someone should make if they're about to go into a relationship with you that might be different from when they're dating someone else?
I'm quite blunt.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm dating someone at the moment, and they literally said, "I was so, you know," I said, "Oh, can I have you, you know, went up to that first date," and I was like, "Oh, from Hinge." And I was like, "Oh, let's get your number then so I can interact afterwards." And he said, "I was so stunned that you asked me for my number and you were just so blunt." And I was like, "Is that not what people do when they want to see someone again? Is ask for their number?" I was just like, "Oh," and that's when I sort of mentioned about the order zone. I'm like, I ask for what I want. I'm very blunt. I don't beat around the bush.
Choice of venues as well, like loud music. That's another thing that wouldn't occur to people ordinarily, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't like to meet up in clubs. I don't really like meeting up for dinner. I like going doing something fun, like going for a walk in the park. VR gaming was one. Escape rooms, fun things where you can sort of don't have to rely on that talking, where I feel I dig myself a hole. Whereas dinner, and you have to sit there facing face to face, and I'm like, I tend to talk best when I'm you know, in a car and I can chat someone, I'm not having to make eye contact because I can think better. And I like being in the open. I'm a rural gal at heart. I like being out in nature.
And it's a relatively new thing, isn't it, last 20 years or so, that adults who are high functioning were getting diagnosed as adults at all. Either you got diagnosed as a kid or you missed the boat, right?
Yeah. And interestingly enough, my uncle, he kind of came up to me at my brother's wedding last summer and was asking me questions about, you know, the whole process of diagnosis. You know, is it worthwhile? And I told him, I'll tell you, is unless you're wanting something out of it in terms of relief or adjustments of work or university or school, there isn't actually any worthwhile getting a diagnosis. There is no automatic drug. There is no automatic help in the system. It's usually advice and guidance because it is so, there is so variable and not enough clear research, because it costs too much money and it's not a homogenous group of people.
Had your symptoms been spotted when you were a child, your teenage years and your 20s would have been very different. How does that make you feel, knowing that?
It's hard to tell, really, if my years had been different. Picky eating wasn't considered to be a sign of autism. It was just, oh, child's picky eater. Would they, I had more understanding from my parents? Probably not. It's the way they were brought up. I don't think a diagnosis probably would have helped me much. I don't know. Because it's a situation. Had we not moved, would I have ever had those spirals and trigger events? Had I been in a good place in my job and everything at my point my granddad died, would I have spiraled? Don't know. There's a lot of what ifs. A lot of that thinking, that obsessive, what you called rumination thinking, which is very common in people with high-functioning autism. I try to think of, if this hadn't happened, I wouldn't be where I am now. If I hadn't had my diagnosis, I wouldn't have gone into medicine. And I'm now in a job I love. And people can see that. I love my job. Even when I'm stressed out, and like we're having this interview, I've just done 3 shifts on the bounce of 12 hours. as frustrated as I get with it and anxious and panicking whether I've done the right thing, I still come away and love it. But I feel that I've had developed those coping mechanisms that allow me to stay in a good set. And had I not done all of this other stuff in my life, all the things we've talked about, had none of those experiences ever happened, I wouldn't be where I am now.
Our thanks to Lexi. If you've got a thought about what you've just heard, or you'd like to share your story on a future edition of the show, then reach out via the feedback form on our website, blondmanwith2ends.co.uk. And to find out more about autism, we've put links up to the National Autistic Society on our website as well. Up next, your sex and relationships questions. It's Alex Fox, after this.
So
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day John Lennon said the Beatles were bigger than Jesus.
Then on Tuesday, we explain how Che Guevara became a literal poster boy.
On Wednesday, the day the courts killed Napster.
Thursday was the day the Romans did a Sabbath switcheroo.
And on Friday, we recall the forgotten final TV appearance of the Marx Brothers.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts. It's time for the Foxhole, your sex and relationships questions answered with Alex Fox, who has lit a candle in here, and not because you've done a poo, Alex.
No, I'm trying to create a specific ambiance. Mm. This candle usually is used to create an atmosphere within a place called Dennis Sever's house that I recently visited.
What do you mean a place called Dennis Sever's house? Do you just mean in a house belonging to Dennis Severs?
It used to belong to Dennis Severs. Dennis was someone who lived long-term with HIV, but sadly died of cancer in 1999, 2 days before Christmas. But he left the gift of his legacy in Shoreditch in London, bought up this house in Spitalfields in 1979 when the place was derelict. And to be honest, so was Dennis at this point. He moved in with just a bedpan, a candle himself, and a mattress on the floor. But he transformed this abode into his vision of history. And he decided to invent this fictional family called the Jervises and design his own home that he also lived in so that each room represented a different historical period from the 18th and 19th century.
And that's got what to do with selling candles?
Well, he was a very theatrical man, although some of the elements in the room are genuinely antiques. Lots of them are things that he's just cobbled together from walnut shells or stuff that he crafted. And he also added scents through candles and potpourri.
Okay, so this smell is his scent, is it? He devised it?
This is a candle that was made by a perfumier that's designed to help evoke a feeling in one of these rooms. Mm. Basically, he designed everything so it really feels as though you are there in the space of this imaginary Jervis family and that they may have just stepped outside to go and get some eggs from the parlour or to collect something from the street. Anyway, I love Dennis Sever's house. I love that actors are continuing to do these amazing immersive tours.
Oh, you didn't tell me there are actors involved. No, I definitely won't go. Let's get to your sex questions. This one comes in from an anonymous man who says, Alex, my wife and I have been married for many years and cunnilingus has always been part of our sex life. I've always been clean shaved, but recently I've grown a beard. My wife likes the look of the beard on my face, but not the feel on her clitoris. Do you have any tips, tricks, or advice for bearded oral sex?
Side note, does anyone actually call it cunnilingus in real life? I know I do from a sex ed point of view, but it just sounds so clinical to me.
I mean, in a bedroom menu, it's a strange thing to ask for, isn't it?
Although I also
Shall we do cunnilingus now?
I also, though, wouldn't want someone to use particular slang like, can I eat out at the pink taco shack tonight, madame?
Much better to just correspond in complete silence.
Oral, going down.
Oral.
That would be my choice, anyway. So, she loves the beard, but she doesn't like the feeling of his whiskers on her pussy. We're not told here whether this is because she finds it scratchy and uncomfortable or it's just too overwhelmingly tickly.
Yes.
So, I have mined a plethora of suggestions here. I'm going to throw the whole kitchen sink at our couple.
Okay.
I had a chit chat to Dr. Tara, who's actually the sexpert on Channel 4's Celebs Go Dating.
Mm.
And she has her own podcast all about sex called Love Bites. She got straight to the point with three very neat, sweet and petite bits of advice. First of all, she said, trim your beard. You want it to be laying flat and smoothly rather than having unruly bits pointing out so that it doesn't feel like Mr. Twit is going down on your twat.
Yeah, because also, like he says, should I be clean shaven as an alternative to having a beard? But actually, if you're then going to grow the beard back, those in-between stages, that's more itchy, isn't it? That's worse than just having a flat piece of hair.
I have spoken to a lot of people who find the thing that bothers them the most is that stubbly stage.
Mm, exactly.
That 5 o'clock shadow when it gets to
Faith era George Michael.
That is exactly who I had in mind as I was describing that. I don't think he would be into it, but just for the record,
I would
100% volunteer as tribute for Faith era George Michael to test my faith by going down on me. Holy Mother of God, I would give my soul to the dark side for that to happen.
But it would be itchy.
I'd put up with it. This bitch will take that itch for George Michael. What a fine, fine gentleman he was. Anyway, yes. Yeah. Trim, trimini, trim, trimini, trim, trim, chiru. Make sure the beard is neat. That might help dissipate any unfortunate feelings. Dr. Tara's second bit of advice was edible lube.
Okay.
So actually applying lots of flavoured lubricant to your wife's vulval area and clitoral area, so that there's a bit of slide and glide to the ride.
So why edible? Just because the tongue's going in?
I think she was just thinking about making the experience for the giver of oral sex, yeah, a little bit.
That's not
going to
help her be less itchy. Just any lube would do, right down there.
Any lube.
As Jason Donovan famously sang. God, it's all becoming pop music today. I close my eyes. Let's not do the curtain joke. No, I said no.
I was already there and loving it. Yeah, I think Dr. Tara's tip was more that, yeah, you can use any lube you want, but if you are deliberately licking that lube over and over again, having something flavoured is designed exactly for that job. With the caveat, of course, that some lubes that contain flavourings and glycerin aren't always compatible with the vaginal area of more sensitive creatures.
Now, obviously, lube is a good idea anyway, and we've talked about that anyway when it comes to almost any interaction with a vagina. We
with
mentioned
a person.
Lubes. Yeah, yeah,
lube
indeed.
In all circumstances.
Any orifice, really.
Office meeting, lube. Chat with the bank manager, lube. Everything's smoother.
But I do wonder if, for whatever reason, let's say his wife actually didn't like lube, or he didn't like the taste of it, or whatever.
Which a lot of people don't.
Which a lot of people don't.
Even the flavoured ones.
Maybe there's an alternative to lubricating his beard rather than lubricating the fanny.
100%. And in fact, Dr. Tara's third and final tip was oil or moisturise your beard so that the hair itself is softer.
I wonder if we've still got some of that Modern Man beard oil on sale. On our shop webpage, I think we might do.
Now, was that made by Rune Silk?
It was made by Rune Silk, friends of the show.
Surprisingly.
They don't do a cunnilingus beard oil, do they?
They don't, but Daniel Jones, who's the founder of Rune Silk, did have a talk with me to offer up some more tips.
Okay.
When it comes to beard oils, you don't want to be just dipping your facial follicles in crisp and dry. You want to look for formulas that have got things like argan oil, shea butter, jojoba. Those oils will actually apparently penetrate the hair, or like a conditioner for your head, and help make your beard feel silky soft all the time. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, oils don't get along with condoms. So if this listener and his partner are relying upon prophylactics for their safety, you don't really want to put beard oil on the down belows before you then introduce a Durex. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, though, the way that you're supposed to use a beard oil is actually apply it just before you go to sleep, and it kind of allows it to soak in, and then that softness will continue throughout your day. So, yeah, rather than slathering your face with oil before you go down on your wife,
do it in the morning.
Just make sure that you check the ingredients list of what's in your oil to make sure there's nothing that you need to avoid there. Lots of them have essential oils in them, like lemongrass or cinnamon or peppermint or tea tree. These can be quite astringent and harsh. Maybe a bit more than stimulating. Yeah. They can cause a bushfire. Especially don't really want something like tea tree.
Now that does answer, all three of those tips are excellent for answering the abrasiveness possibilities.
Yeah.
What about the ticklish possibilities? You did mention that. What if she doesn't like the sensation because it's ticklish? Now that's not something that any of these resolve because it's still ticklish.
Very true, Ollie. I think when most people are giving cunnilingus, they tend to position themselves so that they are head on between the thighs, right? So it's sort of nose to clit.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually another position called the Kivin method, where the person giving the oral sex actually positions themselves to the side of the body. So they're perpendicular to their partner's genitals.
Mm.
And they lick at a 90 degree angle, if you will.
Mm. So the tongue's coming out, but the beard isn't close.
Or the beard is sort of swiveled to the side.
Yes,
to me, it's like, it feels quite regal, like riding side saddle during your cunnilingus. Also in the big bad drawer of things to try are laurels. I think we have mentioned these on the show in the past. They are very thin latex underwear. aimed at people who want their partners to go down on them while they're having a period but want to avoid mess.
Also, the salt burn issue.
Yeah, exactly. They're also aimed at women who perhaps have some psychological difficulties when it comes to getting over the idea of their partner's mouth being directly on their genitals. You know, maybe if they've had some sexual trauma or they have some body image issues, then having that latex barrier between them and their partner's lips and tongue can help them psychologically get over.
Yeah, I see that. Because I think sometimes after oral sex, then kissing. That's the thing that I always think, like, ooh, where's your mouth just been? You know, it just feels like sometimes that's good and sometimes it's not good.
Yeah, and in an ideal world, we'll say, oh, but we should all accept each other's bodies and get over this.
Yeah.
In reality, we know that that can take a long time to happen. And sometimes a halfway house of saying, well, I can actually still enjoy oral sex, but if I use this latex barrier, cool, go for it. The tool is there for that reason. It can also be useful if you have concerns about transferring an STI like HPV or herpes. But laurels are also fantastic precisely if you have issues with the rough scruff of your partner's bearded face.
Final question.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything she could do with her muff that would make this issue go away? You know, so far, this has all been about what he can do. I mean, I wonder whether her being clean-shaven or letting the bush run riot might help the situation.
Good question.
Or would you get a Velcro-like scenario?
Where they become enmeshed. I'm just spitballing here, appropriately enough. I imagine that maybe if she had longer pubic hair and he had a beard, then that might sort of act as a kind of absorbing layer, if you will. Maybe she can, if she feels comfortable, she can grow out her pubes if she doesn't already sport a lustrous carpet.
Which might make it a bit less abrasive, might
it? It could do.
I'm not on the clitoris, obviously, but in the area around it, yeah.
Uh-huh. Another option, if the beard like really isn't working for her in terms of sensation, is to opt for a toy that imitates oral sex instead.
Does not come with
a beard.
Yes. What is there?
I have just fearlessly taken it upon myself to test these things for science.
Journalism.
Ollie. Yeah, mm-hmm. Journalism.
Yeah, reporting.
I found that a lot of them actually, they suck far harder or just have like a much more intense sensation than some of the caresses and softness of somebody's mouth would. They're still fun though. There's a couple I haven't tried yet though that are new to the market. Womanizer, our good old friends who invented that air pulse clitoral suction stimulation, which is goddamn everywhere now, including on This Morning, where you may have seen me shocking Dermot O'Leary with a clit stimulator recently. They've just brought out a new toy called The Next. If you have tried one of these clitoral suction products in the past and found it overwhelming, The Next might be for you because it offers a greater control in the actual depth of these air pulses as well as their speed. It allows you to make things a lot more gentle on the genitals and a lot more nuanced. There's another German toy maker on the market as well. The Belou, I think I'm saying this correctly, B-E-L-O-U, Belou, rotating vulva massager. It's kind of shaped like half an orange. And I think it's around the same size as that with a little handle on it. So you can hold it in the palm of your hand. And on the base, the bit that you actually apply to your hot spots, it has a little vibrating round pad that also contains five little massagey balls that go round and round.
It's also going to be, inevitably, isn't it, just more sensual to have your partner doing that with the toy than doing it yourself.
It's designed to be easy to use solo as well.
I know, but more sensual with a partner, I would suggest.
Absolutely, yeah. Final left field idea, though, just throwing it in the mix, GIMP mask.
Right, yes, keep the beard in check.
Yeah, just hide it behind a rubber mask.
I mean, I don't know, she likes the look of the beard on my face, he says. We haven't investigated whether she'd like the idea of having sex with a rubber masked GIMP.
It's not my first solution that I'm offering here. Yeah. I'm just, it's part of the suite, the buffet of potential suggestions that I'm proffering here.
There we are. I mean, we've really run the gamut. We've gone from Tim Rice through to Gimp Mask. I mean, really, there's no room for anything else. If you have a question for Alex Fox to answer in a future edition of The Foxhole, what do you have to do with it?
I will attempt to get your problem licked if you go to modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and hit feedback.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this edition of The Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new ambassador. It is Amy Deadman in Somerset, who says, "Ollie, I've been a huge fan of your work since I started listening to Answer Me This as an awkward 15-year-old. I'm now an awkward 30-year-old and love listening to The Modern Man and Today in History with the Retrospectors with my husband George and our 9-month-old Teddy. I've just signed up for 12 months of beer money." You can tell you're a parent because you're thinking in months. "Which is all I can afford right now. But thank you so much for making this podcast available for free each month. It's kept us company through the long nights with a baby. And I would love to be considered ambassador for Somerset, home of the Wurzels, cheddar cheese and Glastonbury." It is a biggie, Amy, but you sound like an enthusiastic representative both for the show and your region. So I am delighted to be able to confer upon you ambassadorship for Somerset. Congratulations. That's it for now. Our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you with something new on April the 10th. Go!